Listen, you may not have caught the plague from Mark. Madge and the children almost certainly have. But you spent less time close to him. If you're still all right, we could escape. We could leave today, you and me and Lola. Caris was appalled by the way he assumed it had spread by now. Was she doomed already? And go where? To Wales or Ireland. We need to find a remote village where they don't see a stranger from one year to the next. You've had the sickness. You told me people don't get it twice. Never. And some people don't catch it at all. Lola must be like that. If she didn't pick it up from her mother, she's not likely to get it from anyone else. So why do you want to go to Wales? He just stared at her with that intense look, and she realized that the fear she had detected in him was for her. He was terrified that she would die. Tears came to her eyes. She remembered what Madge had said. Knowing there's one person in the world who will always be on your side. Merthyn tried to look after her, no matter what she did. She thought of poor Madge, blasted by grief at the loss of the one who was always on her side. How could she, Caris, even think of rejecting Merthyn? But she did. I can't leave Kingsbridge, she said. Of all times, not now. They rely on me if someone is sick. When the plague strikes, I'm the one they will turn to for help. If I were to flee... Well, I don't know how to explain this. I think I understand, Merthyn said. You'd be like a soldier who runs away as soon as the first arrow is shot. You'd feel a coward.
Yes, and a cheat.
After all these years of being a nun and saying that I live to serve others. I knew you would feel this way, Merthyn said, but I had to try. The sadness in his voice nearly broke her heart as he added, And I suppose this means you won't be renouncing your vows in the foreseeable future.
No.
The hospital is where they come for help. I have to be here at the Priory to play my role. I have to be a nun. All right, then.
Don't be too downhearted.
With wry sorrow, he said, And why should I not? Be downhearted.
You said that it killed half the population of Florence? Something like that. So at least half the people just didn't catch it.
Like Lola. No one knows why. Perhaps they have some special strength. Or maybe the disease strikes at random, like arrows fired into the enemy ranks, killing some and missing others.
Either way, there's a good chance I'll escape the illness.
One chance in two.
Like the toss of a coin.
Heads or tails, he said. Life or death.
Chapter 58. Hundreds of people came to Mark Webber's funeral. He had been one of the town's leading citizens, but it was more than that. Poor weavers arrived from the surrounding villages, some of them having walked for hours. He had been unusually well-loved, Merthyn reflected. The combination of his giant's body and his gentle temperament cast a spell. It was a wet day, and the bared heads of rich and poor men were soaked as they stood around the grave. Cold rain mingled with hot tears on the faces of the mourners. Madge stood with her arms around the shoulders of her two younger sons, Dennis and Noah. They were flanked by the elder son, John, and the daughter, Dora, who were both much taller than their mother, and looked as if they might be the parents of the three short people in the middle. Merthyn wondered grimly whether Madge or one of her children would be the next to die. Six strong men grunted with the effort of lowering the extra-large coffin into the grave. Madge sobbed helplessly as the monks sang the last hymn. Then the gravedigger started to shovel the sodden earth back into the hole, and the crowd began to disperse. Brother Thomas approached Merthyn, pulling up his hood to keep the rain off. "The Priory has no money to rebuild the tower," he said. "Godwin has commissioned Elfric to demolish the old tower and just roof the crossing." Merthyn tore his mind away from apocalyptic thoughts of the plague. How will Godwin pay Elfric for that? The nuns are putting up the money.
I thought they hated Godwin.
Sister Elizabeth is the treasurer. Godwin is careful to be kind to her family, who are tenants of the Priory. Most of the other nuns do hate him, it's true,
but they need a church. Merthyn had not given up his hope of rebuilding the tower higher than before. If I could find the money, would the priory build a new tower? Thomas shrugged. Hard to say. That afternoon, Elfric was re-elected alderman of the parish guild. After the meeting, Merthyn sought out Bill Watkin, the largest builder in town after Elfric. Once the foundations of the tower are repaired, it could be built even higher, he said. No reason why not, Bill agreed. But what would be the point? So that it could be seen from Mudderford Crossing. Many travellers, pilgrims, merchants, and so on, miss the road for Kingsbridge and go on to Shiring. The town loses a lot of custom that way. Godwin will say he can't afford it. Consider this, Merthyn said. Suppose the new tower could be financed the same way as the bridge. The town merchants could lend the money and be repaid out of bridge tolls. Bill scratched his monk-like fringe of grey hair. This was an unfamiliar concept. But the tower is nothing to do with the bridge. Does that matter? I suppose not. The bridge tolls are just a way of guaranteeing that the loan is repaid. Bill considered his self-interest. Would I be commissioned to do any of the work? It would be a big project. Every builder in town would get a piece of it. That would be useful. All right. Listen, if I design a large tower, will you back me here at the parish guild at the next meeting? Bill looked dubious. The guild members aren't likely to approve of extravagance. I don't think it needs to be extravagant, just high. If we put a domed ceiling over the crossing, I can build that with no centering. A dome? That's a new idea. I saw domes in Italy. I can see how it would save money. And the tower can be topped by a slender wooden spire, which will save money and look wonderful. You've got this all worked out, haven't you? Not really, but it's been at the back of my mind ever since I returned from Florence. Well, it sounds good to me. Good for business, good for the town, and good for our eternal souls. I'll do my best to help you push it through. Thank you. Merthyn mulled over the design of the tower as he went about his more mundane work, repairing the bridge and building new houses on Leper Island. It helped turn his mind away from dreadful, obsessive visions of Carys ill with the plague. He thought a lot about the South Tower at Chartres. It was a masterpiece, albeit a little old-fashioned, having been built about 200 years ago. What Merthyn had liked about it, he recalled very clearly, was the transition from the square tower to the octagonal spire above. At the top of the tower, perched on each of the four corners, were pinnacles facing diagonally outwards. On the same level, at the midpoint of each side of the square, were dormer windows similar in shape to the pinnacles. These eight structures matched the eight sloping sides of the tower rising behind them, so that the eye hardly noticed the change of shape from square to octagon. However, Chartres was unnecessarily chunky by the standards of the 14th century. Merthyn's tower would have slender columns and large window openings to lighten the weight on the pillars below and to reduce stress by allowing the wind to blow through. He made his own tracing floor at his workshop on the island. He enjoyed himself, planning the details, doubling and quadrupling the narrow lancets of the old cathedral to make the large windows of the new tower, updating the clusters of columns and the capitals. He hesitated over the height. He had no way to calculate how high it had to be in order to be visible from Mudderford Crossing. That could be done only by trial and error. When he had finished the stone tower, he would have to erect a temporary spire, then go to Mudderford on a clear day and determine whether it could be seen. The cathedral was built on elevated ground, and at Mudderford, the road breasted a rise just before descending to the river crossing. His instinct told him that if he went a little higher than Chartres, say about 400 feet, that would be sufficient. The tower at Salisbury Cathedral was 404 feet high. Merthyn planned his to be 405. While he was bent over the tracing floor, drawing the roof pinnacles, Bill Watkin appeared. "What do you think of this?" Merthyn said to him. "Does it need a cross on top to point to heaven?
or an angel to watch over us.
Neither, said Bill. It's not going to get built.
Merthyn stood up, holding a straight edge in his left hand and a sharpened iron drawing needle in his right.
What makes you say that?
I've had a visit from Brother Philemon. I thought I might as well let you know as soon as possible.
What did that snake have to say?
He pretended to be friendly. He wanted to give me a piece of advice for my own good. He said it wouldn't be wise of me to support any plan for a tower designed by you.
Why not?
Because it would annoy Prior Godwin, who was not going to approve your plans regardless.
Merthyn could hardly be surprised. If Mark Webber had become alderman, the balance of power in the town would have changed, and Merthyn might have won the commission to build the new tower. But Mark's death meant the odds were against him. He had clung to hope, however, and now he felt the deep ache of heavy disappointment. I suppose he'll commission Elfric. That was the implication. Will he never learn?
When a man is proud, that counts for more than common sense. Will the parish guild pay for a stumpy little tower designed by Elfric?
Probably. They may not get excited about it, but they'll find the money.
They are proud of their cathedral, despite everything.
Elfric's incompetence almost cost them the bridge, Merthyn said indignantly.
They know that.
He allowed his wounded feelings to show. If I hadn't diagnosed the problem with the tower, it would have collapsed, and it might have brought down the entire cathedral.
They know that, too, but they're not going to fight with the prior just because he's treated you badly.
Of course not, said Merthyn, as if he thought that was perfectly reasonable. But he was hiding his bitterness. He had done more for Kingsbridge than Godwin, and he was hurt that the townspeople had not put up more of a fight for him. But he also knew that most people, most of the time, acted in their own immediate self-interest.
People are ungrateful, Bill said.
I'm sorry.
Yes, Merthyn said.
That's all right.
He looked at Bill, then looked away, and then he threw down his drawing implements and walked off.
During the pre-dawn service of Lords, Caris was surprised to look down the nave and see a woman in the north aisle, on her knees, in front of a wall painting of Christ risen. She had a candle by her side, and, in its unsteady light, Caris made out the chunky body and jutting chin of Madge Webber. Madge stayed there throughout the service, not paying any attention to the psalms, apparently deep in prayer. Perhaps she was asking God to forgive Mark's sins and let him rest in peace. Not that Mark had committed many sins, as far as Caris knew. More likely, Madge was asking Mark to send her good fortune from the spirit world. Madge was going to carry on the cloth business with the help of her two older children. It was the usual thing, when a trader died, leaving a widow and a thriving enterprise. Still, no doubt she felt the need of her dead husband's blessing on her efforts. But this explanation did not quite satisfy Caris. There was something intense in Madge's posture, something about her stillness that suggested great passion, as if she were begging heaven to grant her some terribly important boon. When the service ended and the monks and nuns began to file out, Caris broke away from the procession and walked through the vast gloom of the nave towards the candle's glow. Madge stood up at the sound of her footsteps. When she recognized Caris's face, she spoke with a note of accusation.
Mark died of the plague, didn't he?
So that was it.
I think so, said Caris.
You didn't tell me.
I'm not sure, and I didn't want to frighten you, not to mention the whole town, on the basis of a guess.
I've heard it's come to Bristol.
So the townspeople had been talking about it.
And London, Caris said. She had heard this from a pilgrim.
What will happen to us all?
Sorrow stabbed Caris like a pain in the heart.
I don't know, she lied.
It spreads from one to another, I hear.
Many illnesses do.
The aggression went out of Madge, and her face took on a pleading look that broke Caris's heart. In a near whisper, she asked,
Will my children die?
Merthyn's wife got it, Caris said.
She died, and so did all her family. But Merthyn recovered, and Lola didn't catch it at all.
So my children will be all right.
That was not what Karis had said. They may be. Or some may catch it and others escape. That did not satisfy Madge. Like most patients, she wanted certainties, not possibilities. What can I do to protect them? Karis looked at the painting of Christ. You're doing all you can, she said. She began to lose control. As a sob rose in her throat, she turned away to hide her feelings and walked quickly out of the cathedral. She sat in the nuns' cloisters for a few minutes, pulling herself together, then went to the hospital, as usual at this hour. Mare was not there. She had probably been called to attend a sick person in the town. Karis took charge, overseeing the serving of breakfast to guests and patients, making sure the place was cleaned thoroughly, checking on those who were sick. The work eased her distress about Madge. She read a psalm to old Julie. When all the chores were done, Mare still had not appeared, so Karis went in search of her. She found her in the dormitory, lying face down on her bed. Karis's heart quickened. Mare, are you all right? She said. Mare rolled over. She was pale and sweating. She coughed, but did not speak. Karis knelt beside her and placed a hand on her forehead. You've got a fever, she said, suppressing the dread that rose in her belly like nausea. When did it begin?
I was coughing yesterday, Mare said, but I slept all right, and got up this morning. Then, when I went in to breakfast, I suddenly felt I was going to throw up. I went to the latrine, then came here and lay down. I think I might have been sleeping. What time is it?
The bell is about to ring for terse, but you're excused. It could just be an ordinary illness, Karis told herself. She touched Mare's neck, then pulled the cowl of her robe down. Mare smiled weakly.
Are you trying to look at my chest?
Yes.
You nuns are all the same.
There was no rash, as far as Karis could see. Perhaps it was just a cold.
Any pains? There's a dreadfully tender place in my armpit.
That did not tell Karis much. Painful swellings in the armpits or groin were a feature of other illnesses, as well as the plague. Let's get you down to the hospital, she said. As Mare lifted her head, Karis saw bloodstains on the pillow. She felt the shock like a blow. Mark Webber had coughed blood, and Mare had been the first person to attend Mark at the start of his illness. She had gone to the house the day before Karis did. Karis hid her fear and helped Mare up. Tears came to her eyes, but she controlled herself. Mare put her arm around Karis's waist and her head on her shoulder, as if she needed support walking. Karis put her arm around Mare's shoulder. Together they walked down the stairs and through the nuns' cloisters to the hospital. Karis took Mare to a mattress near the altar. She fetched a cup of cold water from the fountain in the cloisters. Mare drank thirstily. Karis bathed her face and neck with rose water. After a while, Mare seemed to sleep. The bell rang for terse. Karis was normally excused this service, but today she felt the need for a few moments of quiet. She joined the file of nuns walking into the church. The old grey stones seemed cold and hard today. She chanted automatically, while in her heart a storm raged. Mare had the plague. There was no rash, but she had the fever, she was thirsty, and she had coughed blood. She would probably die. Karis felt a terrible guilt. Mare loved her devotedly. Karis had never been able to return Mare's love. Not in the way Mare longed for. Now Mare was dying. Karis wished she could have been different. She ought to have been able to make Mare happy. She should be able to save her life. She cried as she sang the psalm, hoping that anyone who noticed her tears would assume she was moved by religious ecstasy. At the end of the service, a novice nun was waiting anxiously for her outside the south transept door.
There's someone asking for you urgently in the hospital, the girl said.
Karis found Madge Webber there, her face white with fear. Karis did not need to ask what Madge wanted. She picked up her medical bag and the two of them rushed out. They crossed the cathedral green in a biting November wind and went to the Webber house in the main street. Upstairs, Madge's children were waiting in the living room.
The two older children were sitting at the table, looking frightened. The young boys were both lying on the floor. Caris examined them quickly. All four were feverish. The girl had a nosebleed. The three boys were coughing. They all had a rash of purplish-black spots on their shoulders and necks. Madge said,
"It's the same, isn't it? This is what Mark died of. They've got the plague."
Caris nodded.
"I'm sorry." "I hope I die too," Madge said. "Then we can all be together in heaven."
Chapter 59. In the hospital, Caris instituted the precautions Merthyn had told her about. She cut up strips of linen for the nuns to tie over their mouths and noses while they were dealing with people who had the plague, and she compelled everyone to wash their hands in vinegar and water every time they touched a patient. The nuns all got chapped hands. Madge brought her four children in, then fell ill herself. Old Julie, whose bed had been next to Mark Webber's while he was dying, also succumbed. There was little Caris could do for any of them. She bathed their faces to cool them, gave them cold, clear water to drink from the fountain in the cloisters, cleaned up their bloody vomit, and waited for them to die. She was too busy to think about her own death. She observed a kind of fearful admiration in the townspeople's eyes when they saw her soothing the brows of infectious plague victims, but she did not feel like a selfless martyr. She saw herself as the kind of person who disliked brooding and preferred to act. Like everyone else, she was haunted by the question, "Who's next?" But she firmly put it out of her mind. Prior Godwin came in to see the patients. He refused to wear the face mask, saying it was women's nonsense. He made the same diagnosis as before, overheated blood, and prescribed bleeding and a diet of sour apples and ram's tripes. It did not matter much what the patients ate, as they threw everything up towards the end. But Caris felt sure that taking blood from them made the illness worse. They were already bleeding too much. They coughed blood, vomited blood, and pissed blood. But the monks were the trained physicians, so she had to follow their instructions. She did not have time to be angry whenever she saw a monk or nun kneeling at the bedside of a patient, holding an arm out straight, cutting into a vein with a small sharp knife, and supporting the arm while a pint or more of precious blood dripped into a bowl on the floor. Caris sat with Mare at the end, holding her hand, not caring if anyone disapproved. To ease her torment, she gave her a tiny amount of the euphoric drug Matty had taught her to make from poppies. Mare still coughed, but it did not hurt her so much. After a coughing fit, her breathing would be easier for a short while, and she could talk.
"Thank you for that night in Calais," she whispered. "I know you didn't really enjoy it, but I was in heaven."
Caris tried not to cry.
"I'm sorry I couldn't be what you wanted. You loved me, though, in your own way. I know that."
She coughed again. When the fit ended, Caris wiped the blood from her lips.
"I love you,"
Mare said, and closed her eyes. Caris let the tears come then, not caring who saw or what they thought. She watched Mare through a watery film as she grew paler and breathed more shallowly, until at last her breathing stopped. Caris remained where she was, on the floor beside the mattress, holding the hand of the corpse. Mare was still beautiful, even like this, white and forever still. It occurred to Caris that one other person loved her as Mare had, and that was Merthyn. How strange that she had rejected his love, too. There was something wrong with her, she thought, some malformation of the soul that prevented her from being like other women and embracing love gladly. Later that night, the four children of Mark Webber died, and so did old Julie. Caris was distraught. Was there nothing she could do? The plague was spreading fast and killing everyone. It was like living in a prison and wondering which of the inmates would be next to go to the gallows. Was Kingsbridge to be like Florence and Bordeaux with bodies in the streets? Next Sunday there would be a market on the green outside the cathedral. Hundreds of people from every village within walking distance would come to buy and sell and mingle with the townspeople in churches and taverns. How many would go home fatally ill? When she felt like this, excruciatingly helpless, up against terrible forces, she understood why people threw up their hands and said everything was controlled by the spirit world. But that had never been her way. Whenever a member of the priory died, there was always a special burial service, involving all the monks and nuns, with extra prayers for the departed soul. Both Mare and old Julie had been well loved, Julie for her kind heart, and Mare for her beauty, and many of the nuns wept. Madge's children were included in the funeral, with the result that several hundred townspeople came. Madge herself was too ill to leave the hospital. They all gathered in the graveyard under a slate-gray sky. Caris thought she could smell snow in the cold north wind. Brother Joseph said the graveside prayers, and six coffins were lowered into the ground. A voice in the crowd asked the question that was on everyone's mind. "Are we all going to die, Brother Joseph?" Joseph was the most popular of the monk physicians. Now close to 60 years old and with no teeth, he was intellectual, but had a warm bedside manner. Now he said, "We're all going to die, friend. But none of us knows when. That's why we must always be prepared to meet God." Betty Baxter spoke up, ever the probing questioner. "What can we do about the plague?" she said. "It is the plague, isn't it?" "The best protection is prayer," Joseph said. "And in case God has decided to take you regardless, come to church and confess your sins." Betty was not so easily fobbed off. "Merthin says that in Florence people stayed in their homes to avoid contact with the sick. Is that a good idea?" "I don't think so. Did the Florentines escape the plague?" Everyone looked at Merthin, standing with Lola in his arms. "No, they didn't escape," he said. "But perhaps even more would have died if they had done otherwise." Joseph shook his head. "If you stay at home, you can't go to church. Holiness is the best medicine." Caris could not remain silent. "The plague spreads from one person to another," she said angrily. "If you stay away from other people, you've got a better chance of escaping infection." Prior Godwin spoke up. "So, the women are the physicians now, are they?" Caris ignored him. "We should cancel the market," she said. "It would save lives." "Cancel the market," he said scornfully. "And how would we do that? Send messengers to every village?" "Shut the city gates," she replied. "Block the bridge. Keep all strangers out of the town." "But there are already sick people in town. Close all taverns, cancel meetings of all guilds, prohibit guests at weddings." Merthin said, "In Florence they even abandoned meetings of the city council." Elfric spoke up. "Then how are people to do business?" "If you do business, you'll die," Caris said, "and you'll kill your wife and children too. So choose." Betty Baxter said, "I don't want to close my shop. I'd lose a lot of money. But I'll do it to save my life." Caris's hopes lifted at this, but then Betty dashed them again. "What do the doctors say?" "They know best." Caris groaned aloud. Prior Godwin said, "The plague has been sent by God to punish us for our sins. The world has become wicked. Heresy, lasciviousness, and disrespect are rife. Men question authority. Women flaunt their bodies. Children disobey their parents. God is angry, and his rage is fearsome. Don't try to run from his justice. It will find you, no matter where you hide." "What should we do?" "If you want to live, you should go to church, confess your sins, pray, and lead a better life." Caris knew it was useless to argue, but all the same, she said, "A starving man should go to church, but he should also eat." Mother Cecilia said, "Sister Caris, you need say no more, but we could save so many. That will do. This is life and death." Cecilia lowered her voice. "But no one is listening to you. Drop it." Caris knew Cecilia was right. No matter how long she argued, people would believe the priests, not her. She bit her lip and said no more. Blind Carlos started a hymn, and the monks began to process back into the church. The nuns followed, and the crowd dispersed. As they passed from the church into the cloisters, Mother Cecilia sneezed. Every evening, Merthin put Lola to bed in the room at the bell. He would sing to her, or recite poems, or tell her stories. This was the time when she talked to him, asking him the strangely unexpected questions of a 3-year-old, some childish, some profound, some hilarious. Tonight, while he was singing a lullaby, she burst into tears. He asked her what the trouble was.
"Why did Dora die?" she wailed.
So that was it. Madge's daughter, Dora, had taken to Lola. They had spent time together, playing counting games and plaiting one another's hair. "She had the plague," Merthin said.
"My mamma had the plague," Lola said.
She switched to the Italian she had not quite forgotten.
"La moria grande."
"I had it too, but I got better."
"So did Libya."
Libya was the wooden doll she had carried all the way from Florence.
"Did Libya have the plague?" "Yes. She sneezed, felt hot, and had spots. But a nun made her better."
"I'm very pleased. That means she's safe. Nobody gets it twice."
"You're safe, aren't you?"
"Yes." That seemed like a good note on which to end. "Go to sleep now."
"Good night," she said.
He went to the door.
"Is Bessie safe?"
she said. "Go to sleep."
"I love Bessie."
"That's nice. Good night." He closed the door. Downstairs, the parlor was empty. People were nervous about going to crowded places. Despite what Godwin said, Caris's message had gone home. He could smell a savory soup. Following his nose, he went into the kitchen. Bessie was stirring a pot on the fire.
"Bean soup with ham," she said.
Merthin sat at the table with her father, Paul, a big man in his 50s. He helped himself to bread while Paul poured him a tankard of ale. Bessie served the soup. Bessie and Lola were becoming fond of one another, he realized. He had employed a nanny to take care of Lola during the day, but Bessie often watched Lola in the evening, and Lola preferred her. Merthin owned a house on Leper Island, but it was a small place, especially by comparison with the palaghetto he had become used to in Florence. He was happy to let Jimmy go on living there. Merthin was comfortable here at the Bell. The place was warm and clean, and there was plenty of hearty food and good drink. He paid his bill every Saturday, but in other respects he was treated like a member of the family. He was in no hurry to move into a place of his own. On the other hand, he could not live here forever, and, when he did move out, Lola might be upset to leave Bessie behind. Too many of the people in her life had left it. She needed stability. Perhaps he should move out now, before she became too attached to Bessie. When they had eaten, Paul retired to bed. Bessie gave Merthin another cup of ale, and they sat by the fire.
"How many people died in Florence?"
she said. "Thousands. Tens of thousands, probably. No one could keep count."
"I wonder who's next in Kingsbridge."
"I think about it all the time."
"It might be me."
"I'm afraid so."
"I'd like to lie with a man one more time before I die."
Merthin smiled but said nothing.
"I haven't been with a man since my Richard passed away. And that's more than a year."
"You miss him."
"How about you?"
"How long is it since you had a woman?" Merthin had not had sex since Sylvia fell ill. Remembering her, he felt a stab of grief. He had been insufficiently grateful for her love.
"About the same," he said. "Your wife?"
"Yes, rest her soul."
"It's a long time to go without loving."
"Yes."
"But you're not the type to go with just anybody. You want someone to love."
"I suppose you're right."
"I'm the same. It's wonderful to lie with a man, the best thing in the world, but only if you love one another truly. I've only ever had one man, my husband. I never went with anyone else."
Merton wondered if that was true. He could not be sure. Bessie seemed sincere, but it was the kind of thing a woman would say anyway.
"What about you?" she said. "How many women?"
"Three."
"Your wife? And before that, Caris? And who else?" "Oh, I remember. Griselda."
"I'm not saying who they were."
"Don't worry, everyone knows."
Merthyn smiled ruefully. Of course, everyone did know. Perhaps they could not be sure, but they guessed, and they usually guessed right.
"How old is Griselda's little Merthyn now? 7? 8?
10.
"I've got fat knees," Bessie said. She pulled up the skirt of her dress to show him. "I've always hated my knees, but Richard used to like them."
Merthyn looked. Her knees were plump and dimpled. He could see her white thighs.
"He would kiss my knees," she said. "He was a sweet man."
She adjusted her dress, as if straightening it, but she lifted it, and for a moment he glimpsed the dark, inviting patch of hair at her groin.
"He would kiss me all over, sometimes, especially after bathing. I used to like that. I liked everything.
A man can do what he likes to a woman who loves him.
Don't you agree?"
This had gone far enough. Merthyn stood up. "I think you're probably right, but this kind of talk leads only one way, so I'm going to bed before I commit a sin." She gave him a sad smile.
"Sleep well," she said. "If you get lonely, I'll be here by the fire."
"I'll remember that." They put Mother Cecilia on a bedstead, not a mattress, and placed it immediately in front of the altar, the holiest place in the hospital. Nuns sang and prayed around her bed all day and all night, in shifts. There was always someone to bathe her face with cool rose water, always a cup of clear fountain water at her side. None of it made any difference. She declined as fast as the others, bleeding from her nose and her vagina, her breathing becoming more and more labored, her thirst unquenchable. On the fourth night after she sneezed, she sent for Caris. Caris was heavily asleep. Her days were exhausting. The hospital was overflowing. She was deep in a dream in which all the children in Kingsbridge had the plague, and as she rushed around the hospital trying to care for them all, she suddenly realized that she, too, had caught it. One of the children was tugging at her sleeve, but she was ignoring it and desperately trying to figure out how she would cope with all these patients while she was so ill. And then she realized someone was shaking her shoulder with increasing urgency, saying, "Wake up, sister, please! The Mother Prioress needs you!" She came awake. A novice knelt by her bed with a candle.
"How is she?"
Caris asked.
"She's sinking, but she can still speak, and she wants you."
Caris got out of bed and put on her sandals. It was a bitterly cold night. She was wearing her nun's robe, and she took the blanket from her bed and pulled it around her shoulders. Then she ran down the stone stairs. The hospital was full of dying people. The mattresses on the floor were lined up like fish bones, so that those patients who were able to sit upright could see the altar. Families clustered around the beds. There was a smell of blood. Caris took a clean length of linen from a basket by the door and tied it over her mouth and nose. Four nuns knelt beside Cecilia's bed, singing. Cecilia lay back with her eyes closed, and at first Caris was afraid she had arrived too late. Then the old prioress seemed to sense her presence. She turned her head and opened her eyes. Caris sat on the edge of the bed. She dipped a rag in a bowl of rose water and wiped a smear of blood from Cecilia's upper lip. Cecilia's breathing was tortured. In between gasps, she said,
"Has anyone survived this terrible illness?"
"Only Madge Weaver."
"The one who didn't want to live?"
"All her children died."
"I'm going to die soon."
"Don't say that."
"You forget yourself. We nuns have no fear of death. All our lives we long to be united with Jesus in heaven. When death comes, we welcome it."
The long speech exhausted her. She coughed convulsively. Caris wiped blood from her chin.
"Yes, Mother Prioress, but those who are left behind may weep."
Tears came to her eyes.
She had lost Mère and old Julie, and now she was about to lose Cecilia.
"Don't cry. That's for the others. You have to be strong.
I don't see why.
I think God has you in mind to take my place and become prioress."
"In that case, he has made a very odd choice," Caris thought. "He usually picks people whose view of him is more orthodox." But she had long ago learned that there was no point in saying these things.
"If the sisters choose me, I'll do my best." "I think they'll choose you."
"I'm sure Sister Elizabeth will want to be considered."
"Elizabeth is clever, but you're loving."
Caris bowed her head. Cecilia was probably right. Elizabeth would be too harsh. Caris was the best person to run the nunnery. Even though she was skeptical of lives spent in prayer and hymn-singing, she did believe in the school and the hospital. Heaven forbid that Elizabeth should end up running the hospital.
"There's something else."
Cecilia lowered her voice, and Caris had to lean closer.
"Something Prior Anthony told me when he was dying. He had kept it secret until the last, and now I've done the same."
Caris was not sure she wanted to be burdened with such a secret. However, the deathbed seemed to overrule such scruples.
Cecilia said, "The old king did not die of a fall."
Caris was shocked. It had happened more than 20 years ago, but she remembered the rumors. The killing of a king was the worst offense imaginable, a double outrage, combining murder with treason, both of them capital crimes. Even knowing about such a thing was dangerous. No wonder Antony had kept it a secret. Cecilia went on,
"The queen and her lover, Mortimer, wanted Edward II out of the way. The heir to the throne was a little boy. Mortimer became king in all but name. In the upshot, it didn't last as long as he might have hoped, of course. Young Edward III grew up too fast."
She coughed again, more weakly. "Mortimer was executed while I was an adolescent. But even Edward didn't want anyone to know what had really happened to his father. So the secret was kept." Caris was awestruck. Queen Isabella was still alive, living in lavish circumstances in Norfolk, the revered mother of the king. If people found out that she had her husband's blood on her hands, there would be a political earthquake. Caris felt guilt just knowing about it.
"So he was murdered?" she asked.
Cecilia made no reply. Caris looked harder. The prioress was still, her face immobile, her eyes staring upward. She was dead. Chapter 60. The day after Cecilia died, Godwin asked Sister Elizabeth to have dinner with him. This was a dangerous moment. Cecilia's death unbalanced the power structure. Godwin needed the nunnery because the monastery on its own was not viable. He had never succeeded in improving its finances. Yet most of the nuns were now angry about the money he had taken from them and bitterly hostile to him. If they fell under the control of a prioress bent on revenge, Caris, perhaps, it could mean the end of the monastery. He was frightened of the plague, too. What if he caught it? What if Philemon died? Such flashes of nightmare unnerved him, but he succeeded in pushing them to the back of his mind. He was determined not to be distracted from his long-term purpose by the plague. The election of the prioress was an immediate danger. He had visions of the monastery closing down, and himself leaving Kingsbridge in disgrace, being forced to become an ordinary monk in some other place, subordinate to a prior who would discipline and humiliate him. If that happened, he thought he might kill himself. On the other hand, this was an opportunity as well as a threat. If he handled things cleverly, he might get a prioress sympathetic to him, who would be content to let him take the lead. And Elizabeth was his best bet. She would make an imperious leader, one who would stand on her dignity. But he could work with her. She was pragmatic. She had proved that, the time she had warned him that Karis was planning to audit the treasury. She would be his ally. She walked in with her head held high. She knew she had suddenly become important, and she was enjoying it, Godwin realized. He wondered anxiously if she would go along with the plan he was about to propose. She might need careful handling. She looked around the grand dining hall.
"You built a splendid palace," she said, reminding him of how she had helped him get the money for it.
She had never been inside the place, he realized, although it had been finished a year ago. He preferred not to have females in the monks' part of the priory. Only Petronilla and Cecilia had been admitted here until today. He said,
"Thank you. I believe it wins us respect from the noble and powerful. Already we have entertained the Archbishop of Monmouth here."
He had used the last of the nuns' florins to buy tapestries showing scenes from the lives of the prophets. She studied a picture of Daniel in the lion's den.
"This is very good," she said.
"From Arras." She raised an eyebrow.
"Is that your cat under the sideboard?"
Godwin tutted. "I can't get rid of it," he lied. He shooed it out of the room. Monks were not supposed to have pets, but he found the cat a soothing presence. They sat at one end of the long banqueting table. He hated having a woman here, sitting down to dinner as if she were just as good as a man, but he hid his discomfort. He had ordered an expensive dish, pork cooked with ginger and apples. Philemon poured wine from Gascony. Elizabeth tasted the pork and said, "Delicious." Godwin was not very interested in food, except as a means of impressing people, but Philemon tucked in greedily. Godwin got down to business. "How do you plan to win this election?"
"I believe I'm a better candidate than Sister Karis," she said.
Godwin sensed the suppressed emotion with which she uttered the name. Clearly she was still angry that Merthyn had rejected her in favor of Karis. Now she was about to enter another contest with her old rival. She would kill to win this time, he thought. That was good. Philemon said to her,
"Why do you think you're better?"
"I'm older than Karis," Elizabeth said. "I've been a nun longer, and a priory officer longer, and I was born and brought up in a deeply religious household."
Philemon shook his head dismissively. "None of that will make any difference." She raised her eyebrows, startled by his bluntness, and Godwin hoped Philemon would not be too brutal. "We need her compliant," he wanted to whisper. "Don't get her back up." Philemon went on remorselessly, "You've only got 1 year of experience more than Karis has, and your father, the bishop, rest his soul, will count against you. After all, bishops aren't supposed to have children." She flushed.
"Priors aren't supposed to have cats."
"We're not discussing the prior," he said impatiently. His manner was insolent, and Godwin winced. Godwin was good at masking his hostility and putting on a facade of friendly charm, but Philemon had never learned that art. However, Elizabeth took it coolly.
"So, did you ask me here to tell me I can't win?"
She turned to Godwin. "It's not like you to cook with costly ginger just for the pleasure of it." "You're quite right," said Godwin. "We want you to become prioress, and we're going to do everything we can to help you." Philemon said, "And we're going to start by taking a realistic look at your prospects. Karis is liked by everyone, nuns, monks, merchants, and nobility. The job she does is a great advantage to her. Most of the monks and nuns, and hundreds of townspeople, have come to the hospital with ailments and been helped by her. By contrast, they rarely see you. You're the treasurer, thought of as cold and calculating."
"I appreciate your frankness," Elizabeth said. "Perhaps I should give up now."
Godwin could not tell whether she was being ironic. "You can't win," Philemon said, "but she can lose."
"Don't be enigmatic. It's tiresome," Elizabeth snapped. "Just tell me in plain words what you're getting at."
"I can see why she's not popular," Godwin thought. Philemon pretended not to notice her tone. "Your task in the next few weeks is to destroy Charis," he said. "You have to transform her in the nuns' minds from a likable, hard-working, compassionate sister into a monster." A glint of eagerness came into Elizabeth's eye. "Is that possible?" "With our help?" "Yes. Go on. Is she still ordering nuns to wear linen masks in the hospital?"
"Yes."
"And wash their hands?"
"Yes."
"There is no basis for these practices in Galen, or any other medical authority, and certainly none in the Bible. It seems a mere superstition." Elizabeth shrugged. "Apparently the Italian doctors believe the plague spreads through the air. You catch it by looking at sick people, or touching them, or breathing their breath. I don't see how and where did the Italians get this idea. Perhaps just by observing patients. I have heard Merthin say that the Italian doctors are the best, except for the Arabs." Elizabeth nodded. "I've heard that. So this whole business of wearing masks probably comes from the Muslims." "Possibly. In other words, it is a heathen practice."
"I suppose so."
Philemon sat back, as if he had proved a point. Elizabeth did not yet get it. "So we outmaneuver Charis by saying she has introduced a heathen superstition into the nunnery."
"Not exactly," said Philemon with a crafty smile.
"We say she is practicing witchcraft." She saw it then.
"Of course. I had almost forgotten about that."
"You testified against her at the trial."
"It was a long time ago."
"I would think you'd never forget that your enemy was once accused of such a crime," Philemon said. Philemon himself certainly never forgot such things, Godwin reflected. Knowing people's weaknesses and exploiting them shamelessly was his specialty. Godwin sometimes felt guilty about the sheer depth of Philemon's malice, but that malice was so useful to Godwin that he always suppressed his misgivings. Who else could have dreamed up this way of poisoning the nuns' minds against the beloved Charis? A novice brought apples and cheese, and Philemon poured more wine. Elizabeth said, "All right, this makes sense. Have you thought about how, in detail, we should bring this up?" "It's important to prepare the ground," Philemon said. "You should never make an accusation such as this formally until it's already believed by large numbers of people." Philemon was very good at this, Godwin thought admiringly. Elizabeth said, "And how do you suggest we achieve that?" "Actions are better than words. Refuse to wear the mask yourself. When asked, shrug and say quietly that you have heard it is a Muslim practice and you prefer Christian means of protection. Encourage your friends to refuse the mask as a sign of support for you. Don't wash your hands too often either. When you notice people following Charis's precepts, frown disapprovingly, but say nothing." Godwin nodded agreement. Philemon's slyness sometimes approached the level of genius. "Should we not even mention heresy?" "Talk about it as much as you like, without connecting it directly to Charis. Say that you've heard of a heretic being executed in another city, or a devil worshipper who succeeded in depraving an entire nunnery, perhaps in France." "I wouldn't wish to say anything that was not true," Elizabeth said stiffly. Philemon sometimes forgot that not everyone was as unscrupulous as he. Godwin said hastily, "Of course not. Philemon just means that you should repeat such stories if and when you hear them, to remind the nuns of the ever-present danger."
"Very good."
The bell rang for nones, and Elizabeth stood up. "I mustn't miss the service. I don't want someone to notice my absence and guess that I've been here."
"Quite right," said Godwin. "Anyway, we've agreed our plan."
She nodded. "No masks." Godwin could see that she was nursing a doubt. He said, "You don't imagine they're effective, do you?"
"No," she replied. "No, of course not. How could they be?"
"Exactly.
Thank you for dinner."
She went out.
That had gone well, Godwin reflected, but he was still worried. He said anxiously to Philemon, Elizabeth on her own might not be able to convince people that Caris is still a witch.
I agree. We may need to help with the process.
Perhaps with a sermon.
Exactly. I'll speak about the plague from the cathedral pulpit.
Philemon looked thoughtful.
It might be dangerous to attack Caris directly. That could backfire.
Godwin agreed. If there were open strife between himself and Caris, the townspeople would probably support her.
I won't mention her name. Just sow the seeds of doubt and let people come to their own conclusions.
I'll blame heresy, devil worship, and heathenish practices. Godwin's mother, Petronilla, came in. She was very stooped and walked with two canes, but her large head still jutted forward assertively on her bony shoulders.
How did that go? She said.
She had urged Godwin to attack Caris and had approved Philemon's plan.
Elizabeth will do exactly as we wish, Godwin said, feeling pleased. He enjoyed giving her good news.
Good. Now I want to talk to you about something else. She turned to Philemon. We won't need you. For a moment, Philemon looked hurt, like a child unexpectedly smacked. Brutally abrasive himself, he was easily wounded. However, he recovered quickly and pretended to be untroubled and even a bit amused by her high-handedness.
Of course, madam, he said, with exaggerated deference.
Godwin said to him, Take charge of Nones for me, will you?
Very good.
When he had gone, Petronilla sat at the big table and said, I know it was me who urged you to foster that young man's talents, but I have to admit that nowadays he makes my flesh crawl. He's more useful than ever.
You can never really trust a ruthless man. If he will betray others, why should he not betray you?
I'll remember that, Godwin said, though he felt he was now so bound up with Philemon that it was hard to imagine operating without him. However, he did not want to tell his mother that. Changing the subject, he said, Would you like a cup of wine? She shook her head. I'm already too liable to fall over. Sit down and listen to me.
Very well, mother.
He sat beside her at the table. I want you to leave Kingsbridge before this plague gets much worse.
I can't do that.
But you could go.
I don't matter. I'm going to die soon anyway.
The thought filled Godwin with panic.
Don't say that.
Don't be stupid.
I'm 60 years old.
Look at me. I can't even stand upright. It's time for me to go.
But you're only 42, and you've got so much ahead.
You could be bishop,
archbishop, even cardinal.
As always, her limitless ambition for him made Godwin feel dizzy. Was he really capable of becoming a cardinal, or was it just a mother's blindness? He did not really know.
I don't want you to die of the plague before you've achieved your destiny, she finished.
Mother, you're not going to die.
Forget about me, she said angrily.
I can't leave town. I have to make sure the nuns don't make Caris prioress. Get them to hold the election quickly. Failing that, get out anyway and leave the election in God's hands. He was terrified of the plague, but he feared failure, too.
I could lose everything if they elect Caris.
Her voice softened.
Godwin, listen to me. I have only one child, and that's you. I can't bear to lose you.
Her sudden change of tone shocked him into silence. She went on,
Please, I beg you, get out of this city and go to some place where the plague can't reach you.
He had never known her to plead. It was unnerving. He felt scared. Just to stop her, he said, Let me think about it.
This plague, she said, It's like a wolf in the forest. When you see it, you don't think.
you run.
Godwin gave the sermon on the Sunday before Christmas. It was a dry day with high pale cloud roofing the cold vault of heaven. The central tower of the cathedral was covered by a bird's nest of rope and branch scaffolding, where Alfric was demolishing it from the top down. At the market on the green, shivering traders did desultory business with a few preoccupied customers. Beyond the market, the frozen grass of the cemetery was quilted with the brown rectangles of more than 100 fresh graves. But the church was full. The frost that Godwin had noticed on the inside walls during prime had been dispersed by the warmth of thousands of bodies by the time he entered the church to perform the Christmas service. They huddled in their heavy earth-colored coats and cloaks, looking like cattle in a pen. They had come because of the plague, he knew. The congregation of thousands of townspeople had been augmented by hundreds more from the surrounding countryside, all in search of God's protection against an illness that had already struck at least one family in every city street and rural village. Godwin sympathized. Even he had been praying more fervently lately. Normally, only the people at the front solemnly followed the service. Those behind chatted to their friends and neighbors, and the youngsters amused themselves at the back. But today there was little noise from the nave. All heads were turned to the monks and nuns, watching with unusual attention as they performed the rituals. The crowd murmured the responses scrupulously, desperate to acquire what defensive holiness they could. Godwin studied their faces, reading their expressions. What he saw there was dread. Like him, they were wondering fearfully who would be the next to sneeze, or suffer a nosebleed, or come out in a rash of purple-black spots. Right at the front he could see Earl William with his wife Philippa, their two grown sons, Roland and Richard, and their much younger daughter, Odila, who was 14. William ruled the county in the same style as his father, Roland, with order and justice and a firm hand that was occasionally cruel. He looked worried. An outbreak of plague in his earldom was something he could not control, no matter how harsh he was. Philippa had her arm around the young girl, as if to protect her. Next to them was Sir Ralph, Lord of Tench. Ralph had never been any good at hiding his feelings, and now he looked terrified. His child wife was carrying a tiny baby boy. Godwin had recently christened the child Gerald, after its grandfather, who stood nearby with the grandmother, Maud. Godwin's eye moved along the line to Ralph's brother, Merthin. When Merthin had returned from Florence, Godwin had hoped that Caris would renounce her vows and leave the nunnery. He thought she might be less of a nuisance as the mere wife of a citizen. But it had not happened. Merthin was holding the hand of his little Italian daughter. Next to them was Bessie from the Bell Inn. Bessie's father, Paul Bell, had succumbed to the plague already. Not far away was the family Merthin had spurned. Elfric, with his daughter Griselda, the little boy they had named Merthin, now 10, and Harry Mason, the husband Griselda had wed after she gave up hope of the original Merthin. Next to Elfric was his second wife, Godwin's cousin, Alice. Elfric kept looking up. He had built a temporary ceiling over the crossing while he tore down the tower, and he was either admiring his work or worrying about it. Conspicuously absent was the Bishop of Shiring, Henri of Mons. The bishop normally gave the sermon on Christmas Day. However, he had not come. So many clergy had died of the plague that the bishop was frantically busy visiting parishes and searching for replacements. There was already talk of easing the requirements for priests and ordaining under-25s and even illegitimate men. Godwin stepped forward to speak. He had a delicate task. He needed to whip up fear and hatred of the most popular person in Kingsbridge, and he had to do it without mentioning her name, indeed, without even letting people think he was hostile to her. They must turn on her with fury, but when they did, they had to believe it was their own idea, not his. Not every service featured a sermon. Only at major solemnities, attended by large crowds, did he address the congregation,
and then he did not always preach. Often there were announcements, messages from the archbishop or the king about national events, military victories, taxes, royal births, and deaths. But today was special. "What is sickness?" he said. The church was already quiet, but the congregation became very still. He had asked the question that was on everybody's mind. "Why does God send illnesses and plagues to torment and kill us?" He caught the eye of his mother, standing behind Elfric and Alice, and he was suddenly reminded of her forecast that she would die soon. For a moment he froze, paralyzed with fear, unable to speak. The congregation shifted restlessly, waiting. Knowing he was losing their attention, he felt panicky, and that made his paralysis worse. Then the moment passed. "Sickness is a punishment for sin," he resumed. Over the years he had developed a preaching style. He was not a ranter like Friar Murdo. He spoke in a more conversational manner, sounding like a reasonable man rather than a demagogue. He wondered how suitable that was for whipping up the kind of hatred he wanted them to feel. But Philemon said it made him sound more convincing. "The plague is a special sickness, so we know God is inflicting a special punishment on us." There was a low collective sound between a murmur and a moan from the crowd. This was what they wanted to hear. He was encouraged. "We must ask ourselves what sins we have committed to merit such punishment." As he said this, he noticed Madge Weaver standing alone. Last time she came to church, she had had a husband and 4 children. He thought of making the point that she had enriched herself using dyes concocted by witchcraft, but he decided against that tactic. Madge was too well-liked and respected. "I say to you that God is punishing us for heresy. There are people in the world, in this town, even in this great cathedral today, who question the authority of God's holy church and its ministers. They doubt that the sacrament turns bread into the true body of Christ. They deny the efficacy of masses for the dead. They claim that it is idolatry to pray before statues of the saints." These were the usual heresies debated among student priests at Oxford. Few people in Kingsbridge cared about such arguments, and Godwin saw disappointment and boredom on the faces in the crowd. He sensed he was losing them again, and he felt the panic rise. Desperately, he added, "There are people in this city who practice witchcraft." That got their attention. There was a collective gasp. "We must be vigilant against false religion," he said. "Remember that only God can cure sickness. Prayer, confession, communion, penance. These are the remedies sanctioned by Christianity." He raised his voice a little. "All else is blasphemy." This was not clear enough, he decided. He needed to be more specific. "For if God sends us a punishment, and we try to escape it, are we not defying his will? We may pray to him to forgive us, and perhaps in his wisdom he will heal our sickness. But heretical cures will only make matters worse." The audience was rapt, and he warmed up. "I warn you, magic spells, appeals to the fairy folk, unchristian incantations, and especially heathen practices, all are witchcraft. All are forbidden by God's holy church." His real audience today was the 32 nuns standing behind him in the choir of the church. So far only a few had registered their opposition to Caris and their support for Elizabeth by refusing to wear the mask against the plague. As things stood, Caris would easily win next week's election. He needed to give the nuns the clear message that Caris's medical ideas were heretical. "Anyone who is guilty of such practices..." He paused for effect, leaning forward and staring at the congregation. "Anyone in town..." He turned and looked behind him at the monks and nuns in the choir. "Or even in the priory..." He turned back. "I say,
Anyone guilty of such practices should be shunned.
He paused for effect.
And may God have mercy on their souls.